And then do you just whack it up like unedited sort of thing?
Well, I don't know about unedited. I mean, I'll give it to Checkers and he'll be like...
Welcome to Stories from the Pitch, a podcast dedicated to creating a living social history book about street performing and some of the crazy characters who populate this world.
I remember reading, I think it's Huck Finn. They were going on this adventure, and they had the easy way of breaking into the cavern or wherever it was, and then the hard way, which is going, is making this big sort of epic adventure out of it. And there's Tom Sawyer says, no, we have to do it the hard way because that's the interesting way. It has to be this big adventure. And that's really stuck with me to some ways. Like, well, of course.
Jeff Actum is part inventor, part mad scientist, and part lovable eccentric whose years on the street gave him a playground to learn and grow as a showman. He's now creating successful and unique shadow puppet shows, which is really cool. But how did he transition from a street show with a slack rope finale to blowing people's minds with an inventive new take on the ancient art of shadow puppetry? Head of R&D for the Busker Hall of Fame, Mike Wood, sat down with Jeff at a cafe in Edinburgh to get some answers, share some performance philosophies, and listen to some really amazing stories from the pitch.
So I'm here in a cafe with Jeff. I can't pronounce his last name.
Actum.
Right. Yeah. See, I always knew him as Bunk.
Well, it's funny with this performing how you quite often you get to know people as their performing name, and then often you sort of familiarize and make a shorter sort of nickname of that performing name. So yeah, I've become Bunk, I guess, to a lot, which is fine. It's lovely.
Yeah, so here I am with Bunk. We're having a coffee and orange juice in Edinburgh, of all places.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely Edinburgh barbecue weather day. Drizzle, about 15 degrees Celsius.
Liquid sunshine. Lots of sunshine in the liquid form.
And I'm trying to remember the first place that I met you.
I think Waterloo Buskers Fest.
That's what I was going to say, too, but I was trying to pin down the year.
Waterloo Buskers Fest, 01, maybe? 02? You and Cam was juggling, doing like 20 balls in the green room.
Yeah.
And you were like stretching bike tubes, and I walked in, and you clearly were the manager of the operation, and he was the technical.
Yeah.
That's kind of my memory.
I think that's a good enough place to start.
Yeah.
And at the time, I remember seeing a slack rope.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if you finished by juggling on it.
Yeah, I got into street performing when I was a student in Montreal. In the Old Port area, you could busk. And I didn't even know that this sort of thing was done. I kind of sort of stumbled into it. I juggled in high school and stuff. And then you get to that moment of, hey, I could do a show. I'm that sort of personality type. But then, what do I do? I mean, sure, you can make up something of your own, but that takes too much time and effort.
Sure.
So you basically steal.
Yeah.
So I looked around, I think. This is in retrospect. In the time, I'm sure I thought it was a magic.
You were creating.
Yeah. So I learned slack rope, and I knew juggling, because you have to come up with a finale, you know, the whole formula of street performing. So yeah, there was a while there where I was just playing with all these different ways of doing slack rope. You tie one end of the pole down, and then it's sort of a span that is loose, and then there's six or seven guys that pull the other end like a tightrope. And if you get the angle just right, they're not pulling it like a tug-of-war, but they're sort of pulling down. They're sort of only pulling half your weight, and it kind of works.
Right.
But the audience thinks it shouldn't work because it's this Herculean feat, but it's actually not. So it's the first time I probably saw that, you know, a little bit of science and physics can actually go a long way in performing and creating little illusions and stuff.
Right. And to go backwards in time a bit, you said you juggled in high school.
I don't know how I got into all this. We didn't have a TV growing up.
Yeah.
My dad will still boast that I have three brothers, so there's four of us, that he taught us all sort of how to juggle.
And where are you in the birth order?
I'm the youngest, of course.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. So do they even know your name, or do they just teach you to juggle?
And totally the black sheep of the family. Well, I mean, that's a funny word to say that. It sounds racist when you say that, doesn't it? The eldest is a doctor, the next is a very successful IT guy, and the other is a very successful landscape gardener, sort of agricultural entrepreneur, and then me.
Right.
So it's, I guess, taken a while for me to come into my own a bit. But yeah, I got into juggling, and I used to just juggle like mad, because you sort of have that feeling like, oh, if I can just learn how to juggle five balls, life will be good. And that's the kind of interesting thing about juggling, is that it's very quantifiable sort of achievement levels. I don't know, it is a bit of an empty victory when you get there and you realize you can do seven balls for 20 catches or whatever it needs to be, so that you could say that you juggle seven balls. But then you kind of look around and you notice that there's no one there with a certificate for you. That nobody cares.
Hold on. I unlocked this achievement. What do I get?
And then can you do nine?
Oh, damn it.
So it was good to maybe do that train for a while, because that's a whole side of juggling, numbers juggling, and there's a really sort of geeky technical part of juggling where people pursue the patterns. So it was nice to dip my toe in that world and sort of then move on to some other things. And that's when I got into slack rope, because I wanted to try more the performing element, but still keep some juggling. I still enjoy juggling, but not in a performing way.
Right. And did you ever take that slack rope show and just put it in a backpack and go around the world, or was it always festivals?
A bit of both. From the street performing in Montreal, I started to get contacts, and people would come and ask, can we come to your little festival and stuff? And then I saw the legendary Jean-Michel Paré from the Flying Dutchman, a legend, now a very successful cabinet maker in Montreal. Lovely ox of a man, who I think I saw as a child as well. I think I saw him at Expo 86 in Vancouver when I would have been 9. So I met him when I was, you know, just getting into street performing. And I think that was a crystallizing moment where I kind of had that moment of clarity of, ah, people do this full time. This is one of those people. And I just sort of picked his mind. And then he told me about these festivals where producers hire people like him to come and perform again and again and again and again, year after year. And I remember exactly that conversation in Jacques Cartier Square in Montreal. And just this door just sort of opening. And as my buddy Stu Goldsmith says, it's just like this little gremlin opens this door and says, hey, come on in here. There's a whole world. And that totally came from that. So I started traveling with the show. I had to sort of make the show transportable. A lot of street performing, I find, appeals to a very specific male, often, sort of skill set. And one of them is the sort of craftiness and the sort of jack-of-all-trades, because you're just always dealing with your props and how to travel with them and sound systems and all these different sort of technical, I say technical in kind of a loose way. And so one of the tricks was then how to break down and how to be able to travel with it. So this is just around 9/11, or I guess just before it. So you can still fly with a bit of luggage. So I figured out a way, and I think I was the first, and others have now copied it, or the first that I'd ever seen. I can never say the first, to use the golf bag.
Right.
So this was the big trick. The cat was out of the bag. Now everybody knows about it. If you travel with a golf bag in the airlines, they never ask you what's in it. They charge you $10 for having a sports bag, but you could have a body in there and no one would know. So slack rope was perfect. I went to the engineering department at McGill and got a guy to craft me a little telescoping system of poles that I could use, but then broke down into a golf bag. And it made a very satisfying clink, clink, clink when I brought it up to the airport counter and everything. So they just said, oh, you're going golfing. I don't know anything about golfing. And I was just sort of nod and...
Yes, I'm going to play the back nine.
Yeah, nothing. And yeah, people would come up and, oh, that's a nice bag, all these sort of golfers. And there was a while where I felt like I really should learn the lingo a bit or something. With that bag, I still actually have that bag, and I have the gear, and I don't use it and stuff. But I went to Australia, went all over, went to Singapore, went to New Zealand, went to Europe many times. And just, I was actually more into, I think, even for traveling at the time. I just finished my degree at McGill.
And sorry, what's your degree in?
In biology. I did a great degree, really enjoyed it, but totally didn't want to work in biology. And for a while, I was thinking about going to med school, and then just realized that was a lot of work. And I really wanted to travel. So I got into performing really backwards. I got into it because it allowed me to travel, to go to these festivals. But then it started to seduce me, and I started to get into the performing side of it, and I started to find out about clowning and find out about this art form that you can't sort of get a degree in, but you just got to learn by doing, and you can go hunt out these masters in the world and take classes with them. And a lot of great clowning can be practiced and learned by doing in the street. And so that's
right
where I was then,
suffering in front of crowds,
and yeah, just learning by doing it. And I got probably about 4 or 5 years into it before I started realizing I wanted to be able to articulate to myself what I was actually doing. So I was learning things like comic timing and how to work with volunteers in a show. I was learning that through doing, by making horrid mistakes, how to not treat a volunteer and have, you know, kids run off crying because you've embarrassed them inadvertently or something.
Sure.
So I had learned through all these little failures. And there was a point there in about 2005 or 6 where I really then thought, okay, I want to sort of go back a bit and learn these tools of clowning. And so then I started to, I guess, take it a bit more seriously. And then that's kind of what led me to, well, kind of where we are here now.
Right. So, I mean, that's an interesting point. Do you remember your first street show?
Yeah, Edmonton Fringe. I was growing up in the Okanagan. The Three Canadians were storming it that year. I remember doing their street shows. And I showed up with a pair of stilts and some eggs. I was staying at my grandma's house. I was about 16, 17. It was the 13th anniversary of Edmonton Fringe. They called it Franken Fringe. I'd never seen or really heard that much about street performing, but I could juggle. So everybody said, oh, you should be performing. Of course, you need to be able to do more than juggle.
Right.
I had these homemade stilts that were very sketchy. And some eggs. I thought I could make a show with that. And I would do this sort of finale on the stilts. My really one memory is that at one point I mimed that someone in the audience should throw an egg, you know, at someone else in the audience, and the guy did it.
Of course.
Yeah, of course.
Well, the guy on the stilts says I should. He's obviously in charge.
in retrospect, it was probably a very clear moment of the power that you have as a performer and how people will trust you to do certain things. I didn't realize at the moment. I can see it now, this red sweater with, I think I hit a woman and there was like egg all over her and this awkward sort of, what happens next? Does the show go on or do I pull out the paper towels that I have now or do I laugh and pretend that I should have given him the rubber egg, and I don't know, yeah.
So now you give her an egg, right? That's the next part of the story.
I can't remember how that all fit. But I met Frank Olivier there, I met Checkerboard God for the first time there, and I've actually never been back to the Edmonton Fringe since, but it really had that reputation in the time as being this gathering place for all these performers. Met Joe Cobden for the first time,
right.
Who was this tall, scrawny, like 14-year-old, who everybody just thought he was the greatest thing, and he would come and rock up these shows with just using improvised things. He was just a very natural performer.
I remember him having that great line about... My mom thinks I'm sleeping at a friend's house or something,
yeah.
And here he is at the Fringe. Or
yeah.
Such a funny line, but it only works until you're not 14 anymore. But
it's great. All these magicians, and I remember this guy cut the head off Barney, and that, and then Montreal were probably the real formative, well, first plunge into that community.
Sure.
And it's a community that it's just changed so much, and I think it's always going to change. So I was getting into it just as the internet was going. For instance, I still got business cards printed up, but I also got a website. So
right.
I think now you would probably not even bother with the business cards, and you certainly wouldn't send out videos, you just have the website. But when I was getting into it, like you had to do your work and sort of mine out the contracts, and I was doing stuff in Europe, so I'd always be sending out emails and then mailing. And you kind of had to do your own marketing to get the work.
Sure.
Which is another aspect of street performing. It's interesting because not only do you have to know about electronics and travel, you have to also know a bit about marketing and websites. And so many street performers are terrific at websites and video editing. You learn all these weird skills that I guess could be applied to so many other things. I was right on the cusp of things where I managed to ride the wave for a while, but then the wave just got really crowded. And I think that was because of the internet. I really think that a lot of well-meaning websites came up that were good things, that were community building. It's this odd paradox of information. When I talk about information, I'm talking about festivals in Croatia, festivals in Michigan, festivals in July in northern Italy. Like, it's all just there.
Yeah.
So all these festival organizers now, instead of getting a select group of people applying to them that would have hunted them out, now they must get 200 emails a day.
Sure.
At some northern Italian town where they barely speak English.
Where previously the festival was self-curated effectively by like one guy's found it and told three friends.
Yeah. It was just getting harder and harder to get gigs. And I felt my show was still quite strong. I had dropped the slack rope and I was just doing a lot of improvised clowning, silent stuff. So I felt it was, you know, original enough.
Mm.
Enough. It's still a style that many people have done before. And there was this moment in about 2006-07 where I was like, man, it should be easy to get these gigs. This was mostly Asia and Europe and also in Canada. So that was a funny little sort of transition, I think, that's happened. Little towns in Spain that would have been a secret that they had this summer festival on July 14th that only a kind of a select group. But, it was, you know, now once that secret's out and it gets posted on some forum somewhere that, hey, everybody, you got to get down to Seville for their community fiesta on such and such a day. And then 500 performers. And I think that, and also with the information that started going around at the formula of street performing, and as that got out... And as we started to see really weird things, and I know you've probably seen this, where you've been to some festival in Germany or even like Thailand, and you see someone getting up and doing a street show in their own language, and you know the lines they're saying in their language, because the formula just translates, because people are people. And when I say the formula, you know, I mean sort of the build-up to a big finale and, you know, the stock lines, and it's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. Because it works, and it pushes all these buttons in an audience, and it's got all this psychology that a lot of us don't even understand. I certainly don't understand, but we sort of know it works. It's a way to corral people and push emotional buttons to collect money at the end.
Yeah.
And it's quite a sight to see it happen in a language, in, you know, in Hebrew or something, and you just think, I know all those words because I recognize the cadence and the beats. And the So I think that with the internet, and as that information got out, and all these performers came, I've never been to Japan, but they talk about it in Japan how in the last sort of 10, 15 years, there's been this huge swell and incredibly talented performers coming out and just sort of flooding the streets. So all the performance locations just get overtaken. And then also in Canada now, we've got the rise of circus and circus school.
Sure.
So many talented kids coming out with these incredible finales, incredible tricks, maybe don't have a full show developed. So it seems like we're sort of up to busting point in the world. And then also with the internet, the ease of traveling on your own, it's so easy now. I don't need a travel agent to book tickets and fly around the world. I just get out my credit card and I can fly to Madrid and put it in the Canadian passport. You can go anywhere pretty much.
Yep. Unless you want to perform in the U.S.
Unless you want to perform in the U.S. And there was a big thing about 2 years ago, the Adelaide Fringe, which was a very, very important point in the busking calendar every year in February. You just knew, like Edinburgh, you could descend on it as a performer, and there was going to be shows to be had. You didn't have to pre-book anything. Yeah. And about 2 years ago, the main pitch got cancelled, because for whatever, some local politics, and also I think maybe too many performers. And I think that was maybe an interesting result. You know, yeah. Clearly, there's a lot of people doing this now.
Yeah.
Street performing. So for me, the transition then to make the segue into how I got into doing theater shows, I think I was getting a whiff of that starting to happen. And then I was also just seeing the limitations of street performing, of how you're so dependent on the weather and how you have to play at a certain volume. And I don't mean just a noise level. You know, subtlety gets sort of washed out the window because you need to present a constant energy in order to keep people with you. Because as soon as you start to lose them or give them a moment where they could leave, then the people who are on the fence will leave, and then that's another $5 you might not get.
Yeah.
Whereas if in a theater, you've got them and they can't leave. So in 2005-06, I started to think about putting together theater shows. And
I mean, your theater show is wildly different than your street show. Mm.
Well, a clown's got to do something. And clowns, you know, you play music or you juggle or puppets. So I knew I had to do something on stage. You got to have some sort of activity. I took this clown workshop with Michel Dallaire, who's this great clown teacher in France. And he calls it the pretext. So what's this sort of reason that the clown is meant to be on stage? Well, to do a show, but the clown is sort of there to give you something. So either they're going to juggle for you. So then you build up the whole clown routine again around this pretense, which is, oh, he's going to juggle, but he can't find his props and his balls, and then one goes into the audience, and you build up the routine. But the pretense is he's there to juggle. So I needed a reason that I need to be on stage. And yeah, the puppetry, I'd started doing some puppetry in the street, and I was interested in it.
Well, I saw it sort of like a marionette thing, but not quite, but a bit Muppety. And
I had sort of just learned by, I'd gotten some books out at a library in Australia, and God, remember that, getting books out? And
oh, do they even have libraries anymore?
Apparently. Yeah, I remember getting books out, like photocopying pages, and this is only like 2002, too. God, makes you feel old. But again, it shows you the information, how it zips around. I mean, people must see my shadow puppet shows now and immediately go and Google shadow puppets, and then immediately they can just get all this shadow puppetry information. It's one of the reasons I'm a bit tight on... I'm very tight on what I do put on YouTube and how much of the technique I show actually on YouTube. Because, you know, once it's out there, it just sort of zips around and it gets thrown on the pile of information. And something in the uniqueness, I think, gets a bit...
You know, I resisted YouTube just forever. I have never posted anything personally on YouTube. I was using Vimeo or whatever.
Yeah.
For that exact reason, because I'm like, oh, this is... It's mine, and I don't want some guy in Georgia to see it.
But you do want to share it.
That's exactly...
And so I said, look, for 2002-03, I actually got really into video editing. And I just really enjoy it as a craft. And so with the videos that you see on my website now, the YouTube stuff, I do spend a huge amount of time... pretty much frame by frame going through to make sure I'm giving, like, the whole point of my videos is someone is standing in front of the box office, they've got their iPhone and they're thinking about my show, so I want to have something that they can load up. It's only about a minute long and it just gives them that, yeah, this might be cool, let's go.
Right.
So it doesn't give all the jokes. I mean, I hate that with Hollywood movie trailers now where they'll put all the jokes are in the trailer.
Yeah.
You've seen the film, it's almost like expected now.
Yeah.
All the
what bothers me is when you see the joke in the trailer and then it's not in the film.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, like,
that's what about the one joke I wanted to see, you jerks?
No, we just shot that for the trailer. I'm sure they shoot stuff for trailers.
Of course they do.
And people ask me a lot about workshops and stuff, too. And I don't know, I really like, I mean, you can talk about our information culture now, too, and how we're inundated with our phones and stuff. I really like the idea of 60 minutes. They're mine. It's a dark space. All the phones are off. This is a live event. And it's controlled, it's not going to rain, a bus isn't going to come through, and you get to craft and create this whole experience, all these illusions. You get to manipulate their emotions and take them on this journey. And for me, that's why I want to do a theater show. I don't want to do TV, I don't want to do other things. Like, this is what I think is the interesting product, is that experience of the 60 minutes. So I've got videos of the show that I shoot and I use for my promotion. If someone wants to book my show, I've got a big video of the show that...
Yep.
But I try to say, like, look, this doesn't get out. I want people to come and experience that show. Because we've all seen it. Even in a street show, someone will watch a show and love it, and their friend beside them will be filming it, videoing it. And then they get home, and 2 days later, they're like, oh, yeah, that show was great. Remember that guy? That Canadian guy? Great. You were shooting that. Let's go. And they sit down and watch the video, and it's like, eh.
Yeah.
Not that good. There's all this physicalness about being close to people beside you and how they're laughing and the energy of the audience. There's all these things that are happening that a camera will never catch,
yeah.
Let alone a crappy sort of handheld thing. Often, if the show's good, too, the person will be laughing a lot, so the camera will be shaking up and down.
Yeah.
And, or the person will be laughing right into the microphone, which just sounds dumb after.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's one of the reasons I got into doing the theater shows, too.
And then how did you get from I Walk on a Slack Wire to my theater show is beautiful, incredible, magical shadow puppets?
Who knows? I mean, we should say now that I'm doing shadow puppetry and
yeah.
that I'm doing well at that, and I've got a unique flavor to it. I think partly a lot of that has to do with the fact that I've never been trained in shadow puppetry, and I never really even... I don't want to say I've been influenced. I've taken a couple little workshops and stuff, but certainly as a child, I don't remember ever seeing a shadow puppet show. But I think that's kind of the point, is that when we talked about street performing, how it's interesting because you have to be a jack of trades of all these ideas.
Mm.
Shadow puppetry in theater shows is even more so, because there's quite a lot of science involved. I do a lot with the bulb types. There's a lot of electricity. I build my own power supplies. There's light sources. There's all this work that goes into the screens. We were talking about earlier in the day about screen materials. And there's quite a lot of sort of what you could call sort of light science, just knowing different things. And then there's quite a lot of the puppetry craft that you need to know. And then there's also this performance element. And so all these three things kind of come together. And I do feel like in many ways I've been training most of my life for all this stuff. I used to mess around in a workshop just for hours making stuff in my dad's workshop. He used to just let me do that, you know, pound stuff together. I'd make these light boxes that flashed, you know, I'd buy these little kits at Radio Shack.
Dude, remember when you could buy good at Radio Shack?
Yeah.
Damn it.
Now you just buy cell phones. And
yeah. They don't even sell components anymore. That drives
they
me
don't.
Crazy.
What do you buy? Internet.
What if I want 6 inches of red wire? You can't get it there.
Yeah.
Or you can only buy the spool. Screw you. I want the...
It's a pity, because I remember going to Radio Shack and just it was such a lovely place. You could go and...
Yeah, and for $1.82, you'd get a whole kit to make an LED flash.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ah, jerks.
So I was that kid, and I used to make all
me
that
too.
Stuff. And so the puppetry really is a good mix of all these things.
Yeah.
So a lot of the clowning and performing has come from the street performing. A lot of the technical... And when I say technical, I mean, like, how do you make a puppet with a pupil that's moving and a mouth that can get sort of 4 or 5 expressions, but then also I can put on and off my hand in 2 seconds.
Right.
So that's what I mean by technical, like these sort of very practical performance bits. And I've really enjoyed that because I haven't been coming from a visual arts background. A lot of shadow puppetry that have these incredibly stiff, like traditional wayang kulit, like an Indonesian style shadow puppet. They're very stiff characters that, well, they'll have one joint like the leg will move, but then the whole body will be one piece, so they just sort of move like a log wobbling.
Yeah.
And also coming from my film background, I knew I just wanted to have characters you could connect with. So right from day one, I sort of set with this challenge of how do I make moving eyes and moving mouth. With puppets, the body isn't as expressive in a way. I wanted to steal from the cinematic language and focus on... It's almost, I hate to use a pop culture reference, but South Park. I mean, the big blinking eyes, the moments of pause when somebody says something and then there's just silence and the character is blink, 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 blink. And how funny that can be.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make characters that have these big eyes that could just be expressive and have these mouths that sort of have this ridiculous... One of the things I love about puppetry is they're really bad actors. So when a puppet is happy, they're just really happy, and they can be grinning, and you just buy it.
Yeah.
And then immediately, then something makes them sad, and they go, oh, and they go really sad. A bit like a clown.
Yeah, sure.
You would never tolerate a performer on stage having those emotional extremes. I'm a really crap actor. I'm a good clown, I think, and I think the puppets are good clowns as a result. Because the nuance, you just have such a range then.
Sure.
Which, where an actor, you need to kind of keep it real, and you need to...
Yeah.
You can't make a transition from such joy to such sorrow that quickly. A clown can, and thus a puppet can. So I've really enjoyed making these characters, and then making the mechanics. So that's the problem. You set out, okay, how do I make a puppet that can smile and emote in a way that an audience can connect with? And then how do I then make the technical, which is how do I make this actual contraption? All my stuff is made out of cardboard and stuff, and really simple things. Because that's all you need. All I care about is the shadow, so why would I make it out of gold, you know?
Right, yeah.
There's no need to carve ivory.
Yeah.
So I've really enjoyed that challenge that's come out of that, which is all these puppet designs now.
Which, by the way, the Slapdash, the Spaceship Pirate switch is fantastic.
So the Spaceship Pirate, it's 2 puppet designs I managed to put together on kind of an XY plane. I made that a week before this show here.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of ideas that you sort of think about for a while and you try and it doesn't work. You put it on the shelf, either physically or in your mind. I've got all these sort of characters that have been axed from shows
all these sort of understudies that are waiting to get on stage. If just to make it more painful to myself, I often name them. In Australia, I've got like, there's this one, what's his name? Bert. He's this big ogre. He's a great character. He's this really like sad goof, you know, just massive head, and he's got this big beard, and he just looks beautiful, and he's never been used in a show.
Yeah, right.
He's just sitting on the shelf, and he's just like
quietly sobbing.
He's getting weepier and more pathetic every day. And so Slapdash, a lot of that stuff came off the shelf. I remember hearing the director's cut of Genet in the film Amélie, and he talked about in the film, a lot of the little ideas were just things that he had kicking around in his head. This girl that collects stones, and the guy with the photos, and Slapdash is a bit of that, using the bubble to create tears in the eye. There was a lot of things where I just had sort of collected them, little ideas, and I thought, let's, if we can string this all together.
Yeah.
But then with Slapdash 2, I wanted to have a story in it and two characters that you follow. So all these worlds sort of collide, and where they all collide is where I try to keep a nice balance between having the theatrical element of the characters, the story, having a technical element. In Swamp Juice, I really wanted to do this thing with three lights to create sort of
amazing
a long shot, a close-up shot. That's right from the get-go. Let's try and do this. And that's why my stories are quite thin, the plot line. They tend to serve the technical in a way. The plot becomes sort of the tree on which everything else hangs. And yeah, so I'm really enjoying this sort of play space now where I get to be creative in all these different... and where they all come together is where then the shows come out of.
And did that just happen? Did you just sort of walk into a theater and go, oh, well, I am a shadow puppet success now? I mean, was there great suffering on the way?
I mean, I did a show in Montreal, Montreal Fringe. That was sort of my first sort of ticketed show, putting myself out there. And
This was the one that was the vignettes.
Yeah. Yep. It was good to have done it because then I could get away from it. It's so cliche, but it's so true. You have to try things to know what you're not going to do. And I spent a lot of time with this show. There was some shadow puppetry in it, but basically I was in front of a giant screen. So a projector is projecting white, but then I would have very crappy animated elements that were black on that white. So no color ever. But for instance, then I could make thing appear. So as sort of a mime clown, I could stand in front of the screen, and if I just got it right, I could wave my hand, and then, ding, this rose would appear in my hand. A rose that was a silhouette. I mean, I just spent so many hours trying to get through that technical, because all the video editing and then the graphics, and I was working at the film school at the time, trying to make this video. I basically had to just make a video. And then it was just kind of karaoke. I just had to know my cues. And so I couldn't really react to the audience, because if there's a big laugh, you couldn't wait and milk that a bit. You had to go to the next cue, because then this dog's going to appear, and it's going to...
Yeah, and if I'm not there in time...
Then it's just going to look weird. That was awesome. I mean, the timing could have been a bit better. But. So that was a first show where I think a lot of people watched it and probably went, there's lots of interesting ideas here, but it's not really a show. And there was some puppet elements in there. And then, for some reason, I got feedback that the puppet elements were better. I realized I didn't want to be in a video. I didn't want to do tech. And from there, I decided to do low tech. So now I don't have any video in my shows. It's all little halogen globes, and everything's very, very low tech. Everything runs from little switches that I flick, and I don't want to say nothing can go wrong, but there's no computers to crash, just a CD that needs to play. And so I really wanted to make things low tech, because too much of my limited resources, mainly time, were spent on these. Oh, I did crazy things. It was this whole complicated story. I had friends in front of a green, because the film's got a green screen, and we'd film them on green screen, and then I'd switch them into just being a silhouette. So, like, characters would come on and interact with me, and it's the kind of thing I think 30 years ago would have been groundbreaking, and now it's just not interesting, I think, for performers to be interacting with video in that way. Right. Sticking your hand into something, and it appears in the video. And
yeah.
I mean, it can work, I guess, but... It's just, I tried it to realize that I'm not that interested in it.
Yeah.
So that first show that didn't sell well at all and certainly didn't win any awards and was in Montreal was probably my first sort of eh. And then the first show that I really kind of launched was Stick Stones, Broken Bones, and I pitched that to the Adelaide Fringe. This is often my way, is I set a deadline. So I paint myself in a corner. I phoned in December and the Fringe, no, I phoned in maybe October and the Fringe was in February. And I said, do you have a spot in your tent? It was called the Puppet Palace, Puppet Tent. And I pitched a show that didn't exist. It was just an idea. And he said, yeah, sure, we'll take it. You know, pay your fee and, you know, you can book it in. Boom. You got to make a show.
And I have approximately 60 days.
So that's been often the way that I work. I use these fringe festivals and I work backwards from them. So I have all the deadlines laid out. And now that I've done, I did Stick Stones, Broken Bones, Swamp Juice, and now this year Slapdash Galaxy. And each one of them, I sort of work backwards from the deadline dates. And by saying working backwards, I also then incorporate sort of a preview season somewhere to test the show. And
right.
Because you don't bring stuff to Edinburgh for the money it costs to be here. You don't bring it totally untested. It'd just be suicide. So the Fringe has been really, really good and key. I mean, it's not even that they're key. They have been my career for the last 2 years. They've really allowed me to get onto an international stage, get noticed by international programmers. I'm here on my own. I pretty much take all the risk. I pay some producers to put on my stuff, but I take the risk. If it all goes pear-shaped, then I'm the one that eats it. So it's an incredible, incredibly democratic model that works. It might not work for some other people that are doing different shows, but for the kind of product, the kind of show that I'm presenting, it's really worked well because I've just, there's not a lot of puppetry right now. There's not a lot that's doing this mix of clown and puppetry and shadow puppetry with a lot of comedy in it. And it works for a lot of ages. It's, I think, commercially interesting, but also sort of theatrically accessible.
Sure. Well, one of the most interesting things to me is that it's the only puppet show I've ever seen where the puppeteer is also a really significant character.
Like, yeah.
And you can watch the screen, you can watch the characters, and you can also watch you laying on your back with hands on your feet and little men on your hands interacting with switches and lights, turning them on and off. And
you can
make a choice, like, am I watching the technician or am I watching the story? Oh, and you can watch both if you have two eyes, which is really nice.
Remember when I was a kid, or at some point I remember reading, I think it's Huck Finn. Well, at one point, I'm trying to think the exact two characters. Anyway, one says the other, like, they were going on this adventure, and they had, you know, the easy way of breaking into the cabin or whatever it was. I haven't read the book in years. And then the hard way, which is going, this making this big sort of epic adventure out of it. And here's Tom Sawyer says, no, we have to do it the hard way, because that's the interesting way. It has to be this big adventure. And that's really stuck with me to some ways, like, well, of course. And so a lot of the puppetry then, I do it kind of the hardest way possible because that's what's going to be funny and because that's what you're seeing. So if I'm going to do a little scene with two characters, I could just project the video. There's a much easier way of probably doing it. But by contorting myself and doing it in a way that is maybe more interesting visually, then you add, I think, a layer of performance to it that does make my stuff a bit different. Than
yeah, in a very, very good way.
I feel like I'm just warming up. Like I'm experimenting. In French, we say laboratoire. So you're playing around with ideas and you're developing techniques. And that's what I feel that these shows are. They're festival shows. I'm sort of developing this bank of ideas of how to make illusions and the vortex cannon that I use in Slapdash. And there's all these sort of ideas that now I've got sort of this giant toolkit for creating illusions that hopefully are tools as part of an emotional journey that you're going to take an audience. And sort of the next step now is to develop, I think, another show that now takes from all of those.
Right. And then goes up on Broadway for a few years.
Oh, that would be lovely.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I'm still in the fringe world, which is sort of self-financed, self-produced, and often in a rush. There's interesting limitations that are good and bad. Anyone that's done sort of these theater festivals will know one of the big things is because the venues, they want people going through them because, you know, they're business operations. So you have to, they call it get in and get out times. The amount of time you have to set up your show and the amount of time you have to get out of the space so that the next show can come in. You're given these slots. So if I want to do a 60-minute slot, I might only get 10 minutes on either side of that to actually get all my crap in and get all my crap out. If you're doing bubbles and confetti, I mean, it's a lot to clean up. You end up having these constraints on your shows.
Yeah, which is why stand-up takes over.
Which is, I guess, why stand-up takes over, but Underbelly, all credit to them, which is the venue that's supported me here in Edinburgh, have been very generous with me of sort of not saying no. So when I said, you know, I want to build a giant box on stage, they said, sure. So they helped me with the carpenter. We made the box demountable so it fits behind the seating compartment. So we still get it on and off in 10 minutes. But it is an interesting little constraints. They say that in filmmaking often, that, you know, that your budget can often be your advantage because it sort of precludes you from maybe having that helicopter shot or that
right. Wasting
time with all these effects. And so I'm at a nice little sort of junction, although I do feel like I'm sort of bursting and pushing at the limits of that bubble. I do sometimes enjoy that. For instance, one of the great street performing lessons is it's got to fit in a Samsonite.
Yeah.
It's got to fit in a Samsonite.
I know.
74, sometimes 75 centimeters. That's pretty much the longest that you'll fit in the big Samsonites. So almost all my stuff will break down into 75 centimeters so that I can just travel with Samsonites. I don't have to get big road cases. There's great tricks we can do with ladders and bowling balls. But when you're a street performer and you look at those three bowling balls as your finale that you're juggling, you go, man, that's a lot of gear to carrying around. Is that finale really worth it? So that's definitely a lesson from street performing that I absolutely apply to this day. You look at that bubble machine that's the size of a golf cart and you go, man, that's a good bit, but that's a big bubble machine. Is it
but
worth
it's
it?
A lot of bubbles.
But it's a lot of bubbles. It gets really slippery after. There have been lessons from street performing. I'm desperate to try and make that link for you because I feel like that's the audience.
Don't worry about it.
It's been a nice transition that I never sort of planned it. We get so, I think, clouded and biased. Who knows what I was thinking 5 years ago? Do you know? You know what I mean? Like, once you know something, you can't unknow it. And so I have no idea what I was thinking 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, if I ever thought I would be doing what I am now. And I think more than anything, as I was performing and learning about performing, I was just quietly choosing directions, not destinations. I knew the street performing maybe just... that was sort of time in the trenches, that was learning about clowning and learning about performing, but I had a sense that this wasn't going to be my long-term play space. This isn't where my skills were best used. But so much of what I learned there, so much, then as I transitioned and started to play into theaters, it just got applied, and you can just see it. So many performers that come from a more theatrical or a classically trained actor background, and there's tons of serious theater shows here at the festival that I share space with, and so many of them sit there and watch my shows with their mouth open because I'm interacting with the audience, you know, physically touching people and pulling guys up on stage and making them part of the show, which is a very natural thing for a street performer, if not sort of overused now to some extent.
Yeah.
But certainly on stage in a theatrical setting, as soon as you pull a member of the audience up onto the stage with you, you're completely going into a different genre. Like, you're definitely distancing yourself from straight theater, yep, straight drama. Because there's no fourth wall, there's no... it's not only is there no fourth wall, the audience is part of the show.
Yeah, and you're ceding a little bit of control to them, too.
Yeah, but these are all interesting things that...
sure, yeah.
I mean, you can palpably, when a show, I think, and I've seen this in other performers on stage, not street performing, in a theater show, you can palpably smell the change in the energy in the audience from the moment in the show where there's been nobody else on stage but the performer to the moment where, bang, there's one of us up on stage with him. The whole audience just gets a mix of sort of tense, because maybe they'll be up next, but joy that person is sort of, we sort of live, and I'm sure there's all these psychology theories as to, you know, why we really identify as an audience when one of us is up on stage playing and participating with the performer. But there's absolutely undeniably a connection that's created that is precious and interesting and worth exploiting. And so I've got a lot of reactions from other performers that not only is he doing puppetry in front of the screen and we can see it, but he's performing to us, and then, oh, he pulled this guy up on stage! He's shining the flashlight on my head! Oh my god! Like, it's just like blowing minds. Yeah. It needn't really quite that much. Yeah. But it's a bit like, I don't know, I'm sort of a shark among frogs or something. Like, it's just... I'm definitely enjoying that experience of sort of aw shucksing it. But, you know, in street performing, this is nothing. You constantly interact with people. You must.
Yep.
I think we can all think of street shows that are quite boring. I remember seeing years ago a mask show. Mask. I said it.
Yeah.
Mask. A guy.
You didn't watch a mask show.
I mean, look, maybe in Europe it'll happen and stuff when they're getting paid and they don't have to pass the hat. But a guy at the Edmonton Fringe, I think it was Edmonton Fringe, was doing a mask show. Lovely show. But yeah, people were sitting there and booing him and heckling him. And you can't do a mask show in the street. I mean, you can try. You got to be a hell of a performer, and you got to have ways of engaging the audience. So I enjoy that. David Shiner's a legendary American clown. He's directed shows for Cirque du Soleil. And I went to a little talk he gave once where he sort of described how, if you imagine sort of four venues, one is the street, one is sort of cabaret and circus, and one is a sort of stage theater. They all can be varying sizes, but they all have very different audiences and very different needs. When you walk into a Spiegel tent, which are these big, beautiful, old wooden circus tents they have here, that a lot of beautiful circus gets put on in, or cabaret, they're kind of smoky, mirrored, beautiful venues. You can't really do drama and theater. The audience isn't expecting that. Just the nature of the shape of the space and the theater, I think preconceived notions about what we're meant to experience in this space, you have to kind of provide a certain type of show, and you know, you can only expect as a performer a certain kind of focus.
Yeah.
When I'm doing my puppet shows, man, I can close off the lights, I can get it dead quiet in there, I can make it black, I can control all the senses in a way, so you can get a lot more focus. So you need to dial down a lot of the expressions and stuff, or you'll just blow the front door away if you're being too Jim Carrey at them. Then the other end of the spectrum is the street, where you just need to be... yes, I'm not saying you can't do, you know, narrative theater on the street, but certainly in a lot of busking senses you can. You can do it. Like, I've been at great street performing festivals in Holland and stuff, where they'll take a courtyard and block it off, and they'll block off all the noises, and I think you can pull that off. So this is what David Shiner was saying, is that you need to respect and understand what you can accomplish and expect of an audience depending on the genre of space that you're in,
right,
which I had never really thought about, which is basically why this guy doing mask in a busking festival in Edmonton is never going to work. There's just not that focus.
Right. He's got the wrong space, not the
wrong
show.
He's got the wrong space, yeah. He just got the wrong space. And it's a pity, but it's also, like, you got the wrong crowd, buddy. It's not that you're not great, but this is not...
It's not you.
And it happens a lot at these festivals where people will buy a ticket on a whim to a show, and they're expecting a comedy show, and then they go up and, you know, it's tap dancing, and they're like, ah.
No, it sounded like a funny name.
Yeah, we liked the poster.
But I liked the poster.
Yeah, that was a good bit of wisdom that I that I still take with me.
Well, look, you mentioned before we turned the recorder on that you had a story involving all kinds of crazy shenanigans.
So, yeah, I'll leave you with my one war story.
Okay.
I don't have many war stories. I did travel for about 5 or 6 years doing Australia, the circuit, and learning how to shoot perform in Australia. Australia's a great place to learn a show. Well, it used to be. I assume it still is. This is 10 years ago now. I was backpacking and shoot performing and doing my slack rope. So slack rope, just to reiterate, you tie one end of the rope to a fixed point, an anchor. There's a span of the rope, say 10 meters, that goes to sort of my pole, and then down from that pole are 6 or 7 beefy guys that pull it. So if you get it set up right, a bit like a V, then even if I'm balanced on the rope in the middle, the forces that the guys are having to work against aren't actually, they're not holding up my whole weight. It's not dead weight, because the anchor on one end is taking part of it, and the pole where in front of them is taking part of it. I got this gig at a, oh God. It was at a bar in, let's not name the town. Oh, the lawsuit hasn't come through. I don't think it will. I got a gig, you know, it's like $200 to perform. It was an Austin Powers themed, it might even have been a stag party. So it was a bar that had sort of a parking lot in Queensland on the beach. So everything was sort of salty air and everything. And that's important, the salty air. So at the time, I didn't fully understand the physics of my, how do I describe this? So the men are pulling on one end on a pole, and I tie the other end at a point on a pole that's eye height. Imagine head height.
Sure, yeah.
What I should have done is have that tied at ground height, and that should go up to another support. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah.
Just trying to describe. So it should go from low point to a high point, and then I'm walking to another high point, and then going down to the guys. But instead it went from a high point to me walking to the high point down to the guys.
Yeah.
So that now that the guys pull on the rope, instead of pulling kind of this anchor basically up, which is a lot harder to do because you're working against gravity, they're just using this pole as a giant lever.
Mm-hmm.
So you can... And I'm starting... I'm not weeping. I'm just... So what happened is... before, so I set them all up. Remember, they're all dressed up as Austin Powers and they're all pretty drunk. And everything's in a line, right? You see what's coming. Huge, huge street lamp. Like big, you know, sodium gas lamp. Huge. Fucking, you know, 10, 15 meters up. So I'm just going through the routine, and I say, okay, guys, you know, I've got my whole routine, which, in retrospect, my material saved my life. Usually before I go up on it, I do a test, and I had a couple jokes. Okay, pull. Okay, release. Pull. Pull. Oh, don't release when I'm up it. Little joke like this. So I just whipped up my thumb, and I was like, okay, guys, pull. And they're a bit drunk, and they're dressed as Austin Powers. And then just yarded on it, and this massive pull fell on them. So it snapped at the base. Salty air. So it was all rusted to hell, all the low bolts. But because I had tied 2 meters up on it, I hadn't tied it to the base. It was just a giant lever. So it just snapped.
And you pulled down the lamp
post. So this
pole...
So it hit them because it fell... They pulled it right down on themselves.
So what, 6 Austin Powers is this?
Yeah, yeah. Well, what happened is it managed to... We're talking in a cafe and everybody's looking at it. But because the... Now, again, it's maybe a bit hard to describe. In front of them is this my little support. I talked about my little sort of telescoping poles. They call it an A-frame. So that's the point that the guys are sort of all pulling on. That's the... is it a fulcrum? No, it's not. Anyway, so as this big pole falls, it glanced off that and basically saved their lives. So it smashed down, glanced off that. It hit one guy in the head, and he got a big gash in his face. So this happens, and we're all just standing there. The big sodium light smashes on the ground. Huge, like the thing's the size of a beach ball, the big lights on them. So price sodium gas, there's glass everywhere. And I'm just totally aghast. I'm in my costume, I guess trying to... No, I'm not even thinking about the show anymore. They were so Australian about it. They all sort of, you know, a bunch of them fell over, and they're picking themselves up, and this huge, like, 15-meter pole's lying on the ground. And one of the guys is bleeding profusely out of his head because he just got smashed in the head. They're all pretty drunk, so I think that probably saved it. Then we realized there's live wires because the light was on, but where it had been torn at the base, there was now like these arteries of electricity. So we also had to evacuate the area, and yeah, I didn't get paid for the gig. I got the hell out of there. I thanked the guy. I didn't get the hell out of there, but I was sheepishly went up to him, and I was like, hey, is everything? I think I maybe even coyly tried to sort of blame it on him or something, and The guy actually wasn't that. He was pretty cool about it. He was like, it was just sort of in the parking lot. It hadn't ruined his bar or anything. But God, did I dodge a bullet there. Holy hell. Afterwards, I found out that you're supposed to tie it lower so that these guys would have been pulling the pole up out of the ground, which is probably nearly impossible.
Yeah,
whereas
sure.
Here, they were pulling it, you know, like a big lever. I mean, it just snapped. Yeah, so that's my one more story. I will never forget these Austin Powers guys, like, with blood coming out of their head. They were so fun, though. Like, he was still doing the accent, and he was like, I can't even bring myself to do the accent. Yeah, he had his, like, blue velvet suit with, like, blood splattered on it and stuff, with the big cravat.
Gold.
I haven't done much slack rope since then. And never heard back from them for the next year's gig.
Right, yeah. So they went to a different agent, I guess?
Yeah, I guess the word got out. I'm sure they talk about it, though. I'd love in 50 years to, like, run into one of these guys.
Or find out that there's a picture of it in the bar or something.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Six bleeding Austin Powerses is.
They were so Aussie about it. I mean, in North America, I'd shudder to think in North America what could happen with the situation. But in Australia, not that there isn't, you know, nasty litigation society in Australia, but they were just so cool about it. They were just so like, oh yeah, mate, shit happens. They wanted the end of the show, you know. I think I did end the show. I juggled, you know, or something.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I got out of that one.
Yeah, me too.
Holy shit. Good, thank you.
Well, thanks very much for this.
Pleasure.
Yeah, it was very, very fun. I could talk for hours, but we probably shouldn't.
I gotta go, yeah.
Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers, Mike. See ya.
Stories from the Pitch is produced by the Busker Hall of Fame. Music for today's podcast came from Jeff's Swamp Juice promotional video. Links to this video and Jeff's homepage will be posted in the notes section of this podcast on the Busker Hall of Fame website. Subscribe to this podcast via iTunes. Just go into the Music Store's podcast section and search for Stories from the Pitch. If you like what you're listening to, please do leave a review in iTunes as it helps with our rankings and visibility. Do you want to help make this project better? Do you have music you'd be willing to let us use? Advice on how to improve the website or the content that we're putting out? Are you a potential sponsor who would like to be associated with this project? If so, we want to hear from you. Drop me a line at cbg@buskerhalloffame.com. None of those options apply to you? Well, then consider picking up a Busker Hall of Fame t-shirt. Proceeds from these shirts help to cover the ongoing costs of maintaining this project. Full ordering details can be found at buskerhalloffame.com. We also have loads of additional content on our Facebook page at facebook.com/buskerhalloffame. Now, if you walk into a bar in Queensland, and there over the bar you see a picture of a bunch of guys dressed up like Austin Powers pulling on a rope attached to a lamppost, take a closer look at their drink menu, because that event may have been immortalized in other ways, too.
And now they've named a signature cocktail after you.
The Bunktastic, or the...
I don't know, I think Eight Bleeding Austin Powers is a pretty good cocktail name.
On behalf of myself, co-producer Lindsay Lindberg, director of R&D Mike Wood, who conducted this episode's interview, and the rest of the staff of the Busker Hall of Fame, we hope this finds you well. And as you perform for audiences around the world, please remember to use your superpowers for good. I'm David Aiken, the Checkerboard Guy, and this is, was, and ever shall be, Robert Nelson.
Matters not the job you've got, as long as you do it well. Things that are made by plans well laid, the test of time will tell. You cannot count or know the amount, nor the value of a man by the show displayed or the beauty made by the touch of the juggler's hand. I am the Butterfly Man, and I thank you for your kind attention.